From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Domestic violence is a deep-seated issue in Australia, and that point was highlighted at the weekend when rallies took place throughout the country. The protests called for more government action on violence against women and also for it to be dubbed a national emergency. On Wednesday, Anthony Albanese and state and territory leaders held a national cabinet discussion. Various measures came out of that, but also they instituted more work for the future. To discuss the issue, we're joined today by author, former journalist and longtime women's advocate, Dr. Anne Summers. Dr. Summers at one time headed the Office of the Status of Women in the Prime Minister's Department, and she was an advisor to Paul Keating when he was PM. Half a century ago, she helped start ELSI, which was Australia's first women's refuge. Currently, she's a professor at the University of Technology Sydney's Business School, where her work centres on domestic and family violence. Anne Summers, the headlines suggest this appalling problem of domestic violence and other violence against women is getting worse. Yet the statistics tell a different, more complicated story. Can we start with your giving an overview of where we are?
Yes, Michelle, and thanks very much for having me on the program. I'm glad that you asked the question in the way that you did, because I think that there has been a tendency to oversimplify the issue, and in fact it's becoming more and more complex, almost not by the day, but certainly by the year. The situation at the moment is that we have a crisis when it comes to murder of women, murder missing and women killing themselves to avoid domestic violence. Then that's the thing that's upsetting everybody so much at the moment, because that rate of murder has increased horrendously, in fact increased 28% over the last couple of years, whereas other rates of violence are going down. Physical violence is going down in this country, strange as that might seem. What it's being replaced by or supplemented by as other forms of violence, and the worst one at the moment is what is known as stalking, the use or abuse of technology to terrorise and track the movements of women who have either left their partners or might still be living with them, but nevertheless are being surveilled. And that form of abuse is getting worse, it's getting more sophisticated, and it's getting harder to deal with. We also know that there are very clear links between technological abuse and the propensity to end up murdering the woman. So it's something we have to take very, very seriously. There are also things like, obviously, let's not forget the sexual abuse, the emotional abuse, coercive control, and the general ways in which women are being abused and controlled by their partners. And we also having to become increasingly aware of the extent of economic abuse. And that's a whole other issue into itself, which I probably won't go into now. But it's just to be aware that domestic violence, when we started ELSI Women's Refuge 50 years ago now, domestic violence was, you know, wife bashing. And it was something that we thought was pretty simple and straightforward and terrible. But what it's evolved into over the decades is a far more complex and difficult to combat set of behaviours at one level. At another level, it's still, you know, it's very simple. Men are abusing women and are not paying consequences for it. And we have to be much more diligent and determined in going after the perpetrators of these crimes.
So is this increasing complexity the main reason why we're not making more progress?
Well, in my view, it's one of the reasons. I think that what we have to do, what I personally advocate, this is not necessarily, you know, a widely shared view, but I think that we have to treat the different forms of domestic violence differently. Some of them are much easier to address than others. Instead of having a blanket old domestic violence policy, this is what we do, because we don't really know what to do. One question that I'm asking, and I'm sure a lot of other people are asking at the moment, is what on earth is happening that we've got this 28% increase in murders of women in the last 3 years? What has happened in our society that has led to this horrendous thing? I mean, almost every day now, a woman is murdered. Why is that happening? And it wasn't happening 5 years ago. So, you know, we need to be really throwing all our research resources at that to try and find out. But when it comes to other forms of violence, I mean, obviously you respond to financial abuse differently than you respond to sexual abuse. So we need different techniques and different remedies for different types of violence. And I think we need to be becoming a bit more sophisticated in our approach rather than just, you know, a one-size-fits-all, let's end domestic violence. Well, sure, but it's not that simple when you have different forms of behaviour that I think need to be responded to differently.
Well, do you have any theory about that increase in the numbers in the immediate term?
I don't. I'm absolutely bewildered by it. It's happened fairly quickly. We've really only become conscious of it in the past year, and we've become really conscious of it in the past 6 months or so. And then yesterday, the Australian Institute of Criminology published figures that confirmed that it's even worse than we thought by saying that there's been an increase of 28% in the past 3 years. Prior to that, femicide, that is the murder of women, had been declining rapidly since the 1990s. I mean, so that it got to being something like, you know, one woman every 12 days. I mean, that's horrendous. But what we have now is one woman every 3 or 4 days being murdered. So I don't know, but I think it's urgent that we find out.
This is, of course, post-pandemic. So could that have had anything to do with it?
Well, that's a question people are asking. If it has, how? And I mean, how would COVID have affected that? I mean, has it been the fact of the decline in income that has come with at the end of COVID? Because remember, we all got paid to stay at home and did nothing. And that money changed the dynamics within a lot of relationships. So losing that money has been catastrophic for a lot of people. So maybe that is related. I'm not saying it's the cause, but maybe it's one of the factors. And I just don't know what the other factors are. But all I'm saying is that we have to identify that this is a huge issue, and we have to find out what's causing it.
National Cabinet met today on this whole issue of gendered violence. What was your take out from that meeting?
Well, I'm quite impressed actually by a lot of it. I quickly read the media coverage of it and thought, well, God, there's not much happened. So I decided I'd go to the original source and went to the Prime Minister's media release. And I found it was quite reassuring that the meeting had addressed a lot more than just some of the sort of, if you like, sexy items about to do with deep fakes and regulating the age at which children can watch porn. I mean, for example, the First Minister's recommitted their, to my view, somewhat controversial pledge that they made 2 years ago that they would end violence against women in a generation. Now, they have recommitted to that today. And having done so in this context suggests they better get busy with how they're going to make it happen. And what they agreed to were the priorities for all of the governments were to strengthen accountability and consequences for perpetrators, including early intervention with high-risk perpetrators and serial offenders, and best practice justice responses that support people who have experienced violence. Now, that one sentence contains a multitude of policy and practice outcomes. Similarly, the second principle was strengthening and building on prevention work through targeted evidence-based approaches. I suspect there's going to be some major announcements made behind that one over the coming days. And then finally, maintaining a focus on missing and murdered First Nations women and children, and the impact of domestic and family violence in First Nations communities. Now, none of those principles have been mentioned by anyone in the media that I can tell.
Just coming back, however, to the promised legislation against deep fake porn, which points to the government's desire to try to do something to deal with the effect of the internet and the various bad sites there. We've seen how difficult it's been for the government to try to remove a video after the church stabbing. How realistic is it, do you think, that the government will be able to stop harmful material from being uploaded, or from, more to the point, children having access to harmful material?
Well, they're two separate things. I mean, actually, the government will find it very easy because they're already doing it. I mean, the eSafety Commissioner has got a tremendous track record in having deepfake pornography and other fake images of women removed from the internet. It's got something like a 90% success rate. I think, I don't have the figures in front of me, but it's very, very high. It's possible to do it. I mean, the whole stoush with Elon Musk about the video in the church is a whole separate issue, and I don't think it's at all relevant to talking about this issue. That's a political fight between the Australian government and a technology company, which is to do with other issues and not to do with pornography and sexual issues. I think the way in which they are proposing to control the age at which children can access pornography is something that's very interesting. I don't know enough about that technology to know how successful it's likely to be, but I've got a lot of faith in Julie and her capabilities. So I think if she's proposing it, she knows it can be done. So I think that's a very good thing.
What role do you think the internet and social media play in gender-based violence? Do you support this age requirement if it can be done?
Well, I think the thing about the age requirement, the thing that's got everybody very, very disturbed, rightly so in my opinion, is that children as young as 6 and 7 have access to violent pornography on their phones or their watches or on their personal devices, stuff that that would have shocked us in our 30s. These kids are seeing every day, and what it's doing, it's giving them a very distorted, unrealistic notion about what sex is about, and this is being reflected in sexual behaviour, particularly amongst teenagers and people in their early 20s. That is not only disturbing in itself, but it's got implications for violence and even death. I mean, one of the things that's happening a lot, according to everything that I read in this area, is that boys now think that, having watched pornography and watched this behaviour, that girls really like to be choked during sex. Now, girls don't really like being choked, and the risks of choking and the risks of death from strangulation as a result of this behaviour are very, very real. And we do know that strangulation is one of the leading indicators of future death for women. So it's something we have to take very, very seriously. If 7-year-old kids are learning that this is the way you have sex, they're unwittingly being turned into violent people in ways that I'm sure they don't want to be, and certainly society doesn't want them to be. So I think this is a very important initiative, and let's hope it works.
Do you think that access to social media is one reason for the fact that young men seem to have worse attitudes to some of these issues involving women than older men?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, who knows? It depends what they watch. I mean, there is these cults of young around masculinity, and these Andrew Tates and all these sort of people who encourage boys to behave in certain ways. I don't know how influential they are. People say that they are, so I suppose they must be. But I don't think you can blame social media per se. I think that's just one element. I mean, we have to take be aware of the fact that violence is a decision that people make. It might be exacerbated by other factors, including alcohol. Gambling apparently also has an impact. But in the end of the day, I mean, a person makes a decision to be violent towards another person. It's on them. And what is pretty striking, I think, about the patterns of violence in our society at the moment is that a guy who gets angry and loses and goes and bashes somebody up, he rarely chooses his boss or a fellow worker. He chooses his wife and kids. So, you know, this is a pretty deliberate choice about who they're going to target. And I don't know that social media, you know, which is a very broad term, can be blamed for that.
You've written at length about cyber stalking, and you mentioned it earlier. Can we just discuss this, though, in a bit more depth? It's become more prevalent and indeed threatening than the physical version of stalking, it seems. Just how extensive is this, and what can be done about it?
Well, it's the fastest growing form of abuse. What is very disturbing about it is that the kind of equipment that that guys are using against women is very sophisticated. It's the kind of stuff that, you know, that ASIO would only have recently had access to, you know, 10 years ago. Now anyone can get hold of it. It's very cheap and it's very easy to operate. The two disturbing things are, is it can be operated on remotely so that you can, a predator or a perpetrator or whatever you want to call these guys, he can install spyware on the telephone of his former partner remotely without her knowledge. That enables him to listen into all her calls, read her texts, read her photographs, and generally have tabs on her. So that's one form of surveillance. What is being discovered when women turn up at refuges, and they do, most refuges, if they have the resources, do an audit of everyone's devices and everybody's property just to make sure that they're technologically clean. And what they're finding is that, you know, teddy bears have got eyes, have got cameras behind them. That there was a case I heard last week about a woman who had a walking stick, and there were seven separate spyware devices within her walking stick. You find that cars are bugged, all devices are bugged, and it's something that's the other thing that's happening, which is even worse, is the way in which, well, I don't know if it's worse, but it's equally horrendous, the ways in which men are using remote technology to terrorize the women they still live with. So we know, I think we read a case at the weekend about the talking fridge. I mean, a smart fridge. It's got a screen on the door where you know, apparently write down what your shopping list is and so on. That has two way access, and a guy can actually spy on his wife while she's at home in the kitchen through the fridge. You've also had examples of men locking the house so that the woman cannot leave during the day, of turning on loud music. I mean, this is literally a form of torture. This is something, if you remember the Manchurian Candidate, loud music playing, you know, 24/7 is a form of torture. These guys activate loud music. The woman is unable to turn it down, and she's unable to leave the house. So these sorts of things are happening in everyday houses in the suburbs, and they're incredibly hard to detect. And they're incredibly hard. I mean, they're easier to stop once you know about them, but finding out about them and then stopping them from being repeated is a huge, huge challenge. And it's something that I wish had got a bit more attention today at the Premier's meeting. I mean, perhaps it is there buried in some of the principles. I hope it is. But this is something that I think needs particular care and a particular funding addressed to dealing with this.
Well, how much work is being done on trying to get ahead of this? Because, as you say, it's incredibly difficult in a world where, you know, we see ads for how you can turn on your air conditioning when you're still at work, your home air conditioning, and everyone would think that's a good idea. And yet there's this negative dark side to these technology advances.
Yes. Well, there is a lot of work being done on it. I mean, the police, certainly in Victoria and I think in New South Wales, I don't know about the other states, but they're doing a lot of work on it. It's something that the women's movement itself is kind of, you know, is being forced to contend with, because those people who run frontline services find that the women who come seeking help from them are often victims of this kind of surveillance and have been affected by spyware. So What has to happen is that everybody has to become very educated about the potential of this stuff. They have to be able to detect it. I mean, one of the issues, for example, the woman I know who runs one of the refuges in Sydney said to me is, you know, that most families are mandated to, you know, have the children visit the father. You know, the mandatory visit to McDonald's once a fortnight or whatever it is to meet the father. And the big question is, do you allow the kid to take his phone or her phone with them, knowing that the father might, you know, put something on it during the meeting? There's been stories of kids going off for the meeting with the father and coming back with a new doll. And it turns out the doll's got, you know, spyware inside it. So it's just an ongoing thing. And these guys are getting cleverer. The stuff is getting cheaper. It's incredibly easy to find. It's all over the internet. You know, how to spy on your wife. I think it's, you know, when we talk about a national emergency, I think this and the murders really do constitute a national emergency that go to our very survival.
Can we just talk about educational institutions, Anne? We read reports about multiple reports about the bad behaviour by young boys in schools directed not just at their fellow female classmates but also at teachers. Universities have been criticised for inadequate responses to sexual harassment and violence. What more needs to be done at this school and university level?
Look, Michelle, it's not an area that I'm very familiar with, so I can't really give you much advice except to say that, you know, I think the fact that students at universities are being subjected to extraordinary degrees of sexual harassment and sexual assault has been very well documented and needs to be taken very, very seriously by university authorities. When it comes to teachers being attacked by students and increasingly I hear parents, honestly, I don't know. I don't know what you do about that. It's not my area.
Do you think that this harassment at university level has increased a great deal over the years? When you were a student, was this level of harassment?
I don't think. I mean, we lived in a different universe. We honestly did. We weren't aware of it, or we certainly, you know, the whole environment in which, you know, you weren't allowed to be involved with a teacher, that was all very different back then. I mean, some of us wanted to be involved with our teachers, and nobody thought anything of it. I think the whole sort of cultural environment has changed. We've recognised the power dynamics involved in those sorts of relationships, and that it's not, however, you know, interested a young girl might be in her teacher, it is not really a fair and equitable relationship for her to enter into, particularly given the amount of power a teacher has over a student and their future career. So, you know, some of those things, I think, the rules around that, I think, are probably necessary. But the world is a different place now.
So are you saying that, say, at university level it was more permissive but less threatening when you were a student?
I don't recall being threatened.
Yeah, it's an interesting change.
Do you?
No, I don't.
Yeah, no, I think it's changed. It's not to say that some individuals didn't, experience unwanted behaviour. I'm sure, you know, we've had sexual abuse for a very long time, but it wasn't as rampant as it appears to be today.
Just coming back to the federal and state ministers, a lot of these issues are at a state level rather than a federal level. Do you think that we need deep-seated reforms in the justice system?
We do, but I'm not the person to talk to about that. It's not an area that I've studied, but it is something that I noticed that the ministers did talk about in some detail yesterday. And the police, as I'm reading here, police ministers and the Standing Council of Attorneys General will be tasked to develop options for improving police responses to high-risk and serial perpetrators, including consideration of focused deterrence and fixated threat strategies. I think there's quite a lot of things going on with the Attorneys General, and unfortunately I can't talk about it because I haven't studied that myself.
And all this goes, I guess, to the penalties for crimes and also the bail laws, doesn't it?
The other thing I just would add, though, Michelle, is that when we say that it's all state, it actually isn't. I mean, obviously the states are in charge of the criminal system, and the states control the health areas and so on. But when you think about it, there's a lot of areas that the Commonwealth control where violence is either exacerbated or certainly occurs. I'm thinking about child support, thinking about a whole lot of financial areas that involve the Commonwealth, payment systems and so on, where there is a lot of abuse, and that's certainly on the Commonwealth to do something about those things.
The Prime Minister often talks about the fact that this is not just a government problem, it's everybody's problem. Are you satisfied with the national plan that the federal government put out a while ago?
Well, not really. I mean, it's fine in sentiment, but it lacks detail about how it intends to achieve this extraordinary goal of ending violence in a generation. I mean, it needs to have the plan needs a plan or a roadmap. It needs, you know, a detailed action plan as to how it intends to achieve this goal, and it needs to have targets, which it doesn't have at the moment. And I gather that's because in the past the states have never agreed to targets. One thing I do hope that might come out of the current critical crisis is that states might be more willing to, you know, take the risks involved and set up targets. I mean, they all hate targets because they're scared of missing them. But things have become so serious now that I think we have to rethink some of those reticences and agree to take on those risks. I think the plan. I mean, the trouble. You know, this mustn't forget. This is our second national plan. We had the first 10-year plan that finished 2 years ago. Now we're into our second 10-year plan, and violence has not only not got better, it's got a hell of a lot worse. So the plans in themselves are not working, and we've got to make sure that changes.
And just finally, people often say the obvious, that this isn't primarily a women's problem, it's a men's problem. What do you think can be done by men to play their part in combating this terrible scourge on our society?
Well, I mean, it's everybody's problem in the sense that any social issue, I mean, COVID wasn't seen as a men's problem or women's problem. It was all of us had to deal with that. And I think that we ought to treat violence in the same way. I mean, the difference is, of course, is that the majority of victim survivors are women and the majority of perpetrators are men. One of the things that we don't know nearly enough about, and I'm hoping there might be something coming out of today's meeting when the details are released, is that we need to know a lot more about perpetrators. And we know that 27% of Australian women have experienced some form of violence since the age of 15. We don't know, we haven't got a clue how many men are perpetrators. It could be 5%, it could be 10%, it could be a whole lot more. I mean, one thing we learnt from the weekend, an article published by Christine Nixon, who's a former police commissioner in Victoria, who got hold of some police stats. They are tracking guys who have, you know, as many as five women that they are separately perpetrating against. So we know these are men, these are predators, actually. These are guys who just go after women. What we need to know is a lot more about men and the men who are committing these crimes, and concentrate on them, because it's obviously not all men, and often I think the message that gets out is a bit confusing, and it's directed at all men. And in fact, what it should be directed towards are those men that we know are responsible for these violent actions. The thing I keep saying, and I will keep saying until we start doing something about it, and it's something I'm certainly working on actively myself at the moment, and that is we have to learn more about the perpetrators, who they are, what they do, how many there are, what their patterns of behaviour are, where they come from, you know, what their issues are in their lives. And we know so much about the women. I mean, the women are researched to death. We have, for every 4 years, the federal government does a personal safety survey, which documents in immense detail what women suffer. And that's great. We know a huge amount about that, but we need to have the same level and depth of information about the men.
Anne Summers, thank you very much for talking with us today about this very complex, topical and difficult issue for our society. That's all for today's Conversation Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Ben Roper. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.